Welcome to Sacred Lines, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the University of Colorado's Center for Media, Religion, and Culture. Sacred Lines explores the complex intersections of religion and the media. I'm your host, Art Bamford. In recent years, superheroes have become synonymous with summer blockbusters, and this year is no different. Film versions of comic books like Wonder Woman, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Spider-Man will draw millions of new and old fans to theaters. In this episode, we'll explore some of the religious aspects of these superhero and science fiction narratives, and their fiercely devoted fans. We have some terrific guests joining us today who are both fans themselves as well as scholars that study the cultural significance of these sorts of stories. First in the studio, I'm joined by Rick Stevens, an associate professor of media studies at CU Boulder. Rick's most recent book is called Captain America, Masculinity and Violence, The Evolution of a National Icon, from Syracuse University Press. I'm also joined by Will Ramsey, a graduate student in religious studies at CU Boulder, whose work explores science fiction and popular music. And finally, joining us by phone is Rachel Watson, a PhD student in media studies at CU Boulder. Rachel's research deals with depictions and representations of space exploration in popular culture. So to begin, I wanted to start by asking you, Rick, to tell us a little bit about your research and how you became interested in this particular topic of science fiction and comic books, and what are some of the insights that you think we can glean from having scholars study this type of thing?
Sure. Well, I came to this through a rather circuitous route. I was studying lots of issues dealing with technology and the way that we think about man, technology, society, and how those things intertwine. And I just got interested in how we talk about them in popular spaces. The origin of my my book on Captain America actually happened in a toy store when I was shopping one Christmas for my nephew. This would have been around 2003, pretty soon after the invasion of Iraq. And I saw a collection of small Marvel posters that were issued in kind of in this very inspirational for kids, you know, and one of them was Captain America, and it said patriotism and had a quote from John F. Kennedy underneath it. And I saw that and thought, wow, that's interesting. Today, this has a whole new context. And then that suddenly made me wonder what were they doing in comics to deal with 9/11 in this interesting moment. And so I went to a comic book store, first time in a long time I'd been in one, and started pulling some of the work that was going on, and found this very engaged and critical critique of the Bush administration and the war on terror and global foreign policy. And that in turn got me interested in, wait, how did they get here to this moment? Because that was a very bizarre moment in our history. I don't, if you remember, there were not a lot of critiques of the administration right around the time of the invasion. And that got me interested in this more longitudinal. I had read some of those books when I was younger and remembered a lot of political discourse and a lot of engagement. But I also remember they moved away from that. And so that kind of idea that sometimes pop culture is a respite, a place of disengagement for a lot of people that suddenly will become political and suddenly will engage. And that just got me interested in that text and then more broadly into the ways in which pop culture at the time were serving to get to some of the cultural conflicts that were going on. This was right about the time that Jon Stewart and The Daily Show rose to prominence and took this very particular use of humor and entertainment to engage important social issues. And then the more I delved into that space, I was able to use my understandings of structure in the way that political economy and those, you know, ways we formally study cultural production started applying into these more conventional popular spaces to allow people to say things, to engage things in a space that we consider kind of quote-unquote play, but honestly is a very serious space at the end of the day for most of us with all that passion.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. And Will, I wanted to ask you a kind of a similar question because you're in religious studies. So coming at similar sort of topics of pop culture and so on. But what's kind of the draw for you as someone interested in religion to study these sorts of things?
Right. So I think that religion and science fiction interact at several levels. And you can kind of trace the way that explicit sort of pre-existing religions that we acknowledge as religions often show up in science fiction and comic books. So one very contemporary example, and I think Rachel can talk about this a little bit more, there are Mormons in the sci-fi series The Expanse and also the novels that it's based on. And then a kind of an older example, I think of the novel A Canticle for Leibowitz, which traces Catholicism after kind of a post-apocalyptic moment on Earth. And so it's very much engaged with that sort of pre-existing religion. And then often science fiction stories will come up with their own new religions. Battlestar Galactica did this. Star Trek Deep Space Nine in the 90s. The Bajoran religion is very, very well fleshed out. So we have these sort of religions inside of science fiction. And then there's also the sort of, you can come at it from a different angle, the way that science fiction is religious. That we're dealing with stories that have their own sort of what we call cosmogonies, why the way the universe came into existence, and these cosmologies, the way the universe is organized. You have superhuman beings who are interacting the same way ancient religious heroes have. Sometimes they even have a messiah complex going on. Lots of times there's even their own moralities imbued. All these things that we associate with religion, they show up in science fiction. And then from even another angle, we can look at the way that fans engage with this, the science fiction. And I'll get to this more when I talk a little bit more about cosplay. But the way that fans interact with this, they're building their lives. They're building their kind of understandings of an enchanted universe around these science fiction series. So from all these angles, it's just ripe with religion that I think religious studies scholars like myself can look at.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and Rachel, Will kind of mentioned, but you do some similar work thinking about sort of futuristic themes of transhumanism and space exploration, which kind of, again, seems to lead you towards science fiction and fantasy. So can you share a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of my work lately has been really looking at actually the contemporary age and the fears that our society has today about what's going on in the world around us, our ideas of collective identity here and now, and what that speaks to for the future. So it becomes fears sort of directed towards the future, but really grounded in the way that we see ourselves today and sort of our fears about the ways in which society seems to be falling apart, or things like climate change and overpopulation and just a lot of uncertainty about the future. And so that ends up manifesting in these ways in which we speculate often through science fiction on potential better futures. And two of the main areas which I'm interested in is firstly space exploration, which ends up being the space in which we can put ourselves on another planet, envision a new future for ourselves, something maybe better, or with the transhuman or the posthuman, which are the speculations about how technology can change the human body and improve on it. So this is a pretty broad area, so I can't really go into all the different details about it, but just these ideas that we can use technology to evolve the human body or add technology to the human body. So the idea of a cyborg is the human with technology sort of added onto it. But these ideas of sort of a technological future in which humanity can evolve into something perhaps better than we are currently now, which also ends up developing in other forms with people who think of it in a more fearful sense, in which machines may become more enlightened than we are and take over the world. We think about things like Ex Machina and the recent movie also Her, where our machines come to sentience and then leave us behind. So those are also sort of visions of a post-human future. But all of these things end up coming back to these fears about who we are now as humanity and what we see the future holding. Either it'd be a better future or perhaps a more disordered, more chaotic future in which humanity is left behind. But I'm always interested in those narratives in science fiction as a reflection on the ways in which we are thinking about ourselves today.
Yeah, well, and I mean, in general, too, I wanted us to talk a little bit about why these sorts of films and television shows and the comic books themselves, why this has all, and I think in what you all have said already, we've touched on this, but why has this all become so popular in about the past decade or so, and what's the appeal for audiences?
I think there's a couple of answers to that. Of course, my leanings look at, you know, structure. I mean, there's a structural argument that says, you know, Hollywood is running out of ideas and forms, and this genre, which used to be subculture but has been elevated to mainstream culture, is rich with narratives, ironically, that used to be derivative of movies, novels, and other more widely distributed texts, but had a way of concentrating and purifying, and of course, through all the retconning and focusing into these kind of iconic modes of storytelling. And that's left this kind of rich library of source material for Hollywood to come back through and television producers to raid and bring back into popular consciousness. But it's because those stories were popular to begin with, because they were dealing with questions of humanity and the limits of that, superhumans being in space, imagining what it means to not be a part of this world. That also has a way of capturing our imagination. There's cultural and social reasons too, but
yeah. Well, and Rachel, I feel like you already sort of mentioned this with thinking about technology and.
Well, I don't know if this is answering your question, but I was thinking about it in terms of I've been thinking a lot about children actually and our relationship with children in the society. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be honest, I'm pulling this slightly from Lawrence Grossberg, who's written a bunch of things about how our society has sort of a changed relationship with how we view our children. So for decades before, children were the future. So you had children and you passed down maybe the family business to them, or you passed down your values to them. You built a world for those children, seeing them as the future. And we, if you look at birth rates today, we do not have as many children, at least in the United States and Europe. We don't have as many children as we used to. I know most people in my generation are fairly apathetic about the idea of having children, and that's a generalization, but for the most part, it's not the same sort of cultural assumption that you're going to, you know, have a kid or four. Mm-hmm. There was a day and age where people would have multiple children, and these days, you know, if people do have children, it's usually one or two. Mm-hmm. And I find that actually really fascinating if you relate it back to narratives of science fiction, because it seems like we were replacing our ideas of the future. So we no longer are looking to, say, procreation as a form of future building, but we're trying to create technological futures for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Sort of artificially creating something, which, I mean, if you watch most science fiction movies, you know is always a bad idea, but we're doing it anyway. And then also this idea of going to space is, well, you know, maybe if we can create a new Earth somewhere else. Right. I mean, if you also look at most sort of news articles related to the seven exoplanets that we recently discovered, and all the different missions around our solar system as well, are all sort of speculating on whether there's life on other planets, and these questions of, are those spaces viable for human habitation at some point? We're just desperate to start over, to start something new, and then maybe we can talk again about having children and creating our future through that. But for now, we have to have science and technology as where we are looking to create a future.
So, Rachel, I have a question about that, because, of course, space exploration and the idea of colonizing other planets is kind of a classic trope within science fiction. But there seems to be a new level of energy. Is there some degree to which that's informed by our advanced understandings of climate or the challenges that we're looking for on this planet. In other words, space exploration has a mode of survival of species. That seems to be a trend I'm seeing in a lot of text. I was wondering if you had noticed that as well.
Yeah, I think actually there's a couple of different reasons. I'd say the two key reasons are firstly, climate change and sort of environmental disasters on Earth. That's definitely a key part. People are worried that things like overpopulation and climate change are going to render this world no longer viable for the human species. And so there's sort of this desperation that we need to get off. But the other aspect of it, I think, is actually also sort of a rising interest in nationalism. So if you track American history, there's always a rise in space exploration and questions of leaping off this planet in regards to a pride in nationalism. So our last sort of space age was centered on the Reagan era and before that as well in the 60s. As we started to see this sort of transition into in more of a pride in American national identity, and the space race is very much our sort of chasing after Russia. And when JFK made the announcement of needing to put a man on the moon, it was very much just we need to beat Russia to it. Mm-hmm. And now again, we sort of as we see this rising sense of national identity and nationalism in our country, we're also starting to see a rise in interest in space exploration. So those two things are very much related, though now it's also interesting because I think we have more of a tension between not so much different nations trying to get off our planet, but is it going to be a national endeavor that gets off our planet or a private commercial endeavor? Is it going to be SpaceX? And NASA is trying very hard to make sure that they are the ones that get to another planet first, not something like SpaceX or Mars One. Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Sacred Lines, a quarterly collaboration between KGNU and University of Colorado at Boulder's Center for Media, Religion, and Culture. On today's show, we're talking about the relationship between science fiction in popular culture and religion. So let's rejoin the conversation now between Rick Stevens, an associate professor of media studies from CU Boulder, Rachel Watson, a PhD student in media studies at CU, and Will Ramsey, a graduate student in the religious studies program at CU. But just a recent example, Marvel Comics was launching a new X-Men series, and the artist sort of snuck in these very subtle references to protests that were going on in Indonesia by Muslims in Indonesia. They were protesting, I believe, the governor of Jakarta, who had made some Islamophobic statements. But the issue was released and people started to notice these things. And then they slowly, you know, somebody caught one or two of them. But then as they really went through the issue more thoroughly, there were quite a few of these kind of very, very subtle visual and completely visual, not anything in the narrative itself. But I thought that this was so interesting that the way that people noticed, they were able to share this on social media. You know, there was a reaction from others in the creative community, and then the publisher. I think the artist kind of admitted it first and said something along the lines of, my career is over.
Right,
because he felt like he got busted. And then the publisher parted ways with him not too long after that. But Rick, I'm curious kind of your take on
that. Sure. So this was an interesting controversy from many different perspectives. So I'll start with the boring part of the structure, which is this controversy is caused by the way that modern comics are produced. Marvel, rather than, you know, the old school of having a bullpen of people who are in the offices producing comics, largely seeks out new talent in a global, endeavor. I'm trying to find people with fresh voices who also are trying to break in and will work cheaper. So you can assemble larger groups of new writers and artists. And that's what came into play here, is you have an artist who lives in a smaller kind of village setting, who is not cosmopolitan, who has very particular regional political views, and happens to be, you know, helping produce an X-Men book, which is about as mainstream, and the X-Men Gold series is one of their kind of flagship attempts to kind of bring value back to that property, and was embedding symbols in the art. It was subtle, and you know, a couple of them were political, and then a couple were seemingly anti-Semitic that drew the ire of it. But the other part that's amazing about this story is that that was discovered very quickly, but not by U.S. readers, which again goes back to these are global franchises we're talking about, yeah. and the reach of these industries is tremendous. But as social media picked that up, American readers started looking in, and then all of a sudden the controversy became nationalized and internationalized, and then became this big moment where Marvel fired the artist. Now, the interesting thing about that is fired the artist from the book. This is when everyone's looking at looking at issue number one. Of course, he'd already drawn issues 2, 3, and 4, which 4 still has yet to come out. So his work is still on the way, even though he's been fired. So that's another interesting part of this. Now, the other thing is, when you switch and start thinking about the fan and collector's market, suddenly X-Men Gold number 1 is worth a lot more money. and people started chasing them. It's suddenly sold out, and people are chasing it down because of these kind of controversies, you know, even especially when there's something divisive or even seen as disgusting, that tends to raise the demand for it because people want the thing that they perceive shouldn't be there. And so they start chasing it down. So you can go chase on eBay right now copies of it, but the value is still increasing.
Wow. But again, I think it's interesting because my own work, I deal with Protestant and evangelical Christianity, mm-hmm. But that the nature of that sort of textual interpretation and, mm-hmm. you know, there's the text itself, then there's the interpretive tradition,
right.
There are different
right.
sort of modes of interpretation. And Will, I don't know.
I'm very interested in this discussion about the policing of canon,
right.
And a canon that is being created in front of us. And what are the fans going to accept as canon? What are the fans not going to accept as canon that should be canon? So who gets to determine that canon?
Right.
And I mean, that goes even back to the discussion about the X-Men issues. Is the versions that have the Indonesian statements, is that canon? Or is it the version that is more official that has
right.
kind of wiped those out? Is that the canon? So that patrolling of the story by both the fans and then the people who are sort of the authority figures in this situation is very interesting to watch play out.
And there's a third group. There's a group that is neither a reader or a producer, but has a strong opinion anyway.
yeah.
No, and seriously.
There's no lack of those on the internet.
That comes to play in this one. There's another example where this happened in Captain America comics fairly recently. There was a period, Captain America Steve Rogers famously died in 2006, was assassinated, and his former partner, James Bucky Barnes, became Captain America for a while, and that was a really interesting kind of story. Well, one of his earliest adventures, he goes to Boise, Idaho, and he sees this militant right-wing group that he's trying to investigate, who are doing these kind of, we're dealing with these kind of militant groups, kind of white pride kinds of issues. But along the way, he's kind of reflecting on, wow, the world has changed in the last 50 years since I've, you know, been gone. And he sees this protest, and they're holding up these signs, you know, and they say, get your government hands out of my health care. And, you know, things like this, very reminiscent of the Tea Party protests that were going on at the time. Well, there was a big backlash for that inclusion about how could Captain America be opposing Americans who are very invested in their country and in their values. And Marvel Comics started playing this really funny game with that, trying to say, well, everybody wants to know who did that. And you have the writer and the artist both saying, we don't know where those signs came from. Those were added in post-production after we had produced this. I mean, there's this really kind of funny game. No one would admit to where it was. In all future versions of that, again, they said, we changed those signs so that they do not reference the Tea Party. Lost in all of that, or the readers were trying to say, well, wait a minute, you've got this protest group that he sees and this watchdog, you know, militant group he's fighting, why are people assuming those are connected just because they're in the same comic? But it doesn't matter, because most of the people that were reacting to the image they saw on the internet. Just like now people are reacting to Steve Rogers says he's Hydra. Well, I'm not reading that, and let me tell you why it's terrible. And then it's, and Nick Spencer's like, well, if you read it, you would start to see he's Hydra fighting the Red Skull, who is also Hydra, but is an ideologue. And so he's fighting, that's like a values, an internal value system within a fight within an organization, trying to find what the future of, you know, civic life should be. But it doesn't matter, because if you're not reading it, if you just see Captain America say, Hail Hydra, there's a kind of a just a knee-jerk visceral reaction that says, look what they're doing now, and I'm not going to read it because of my strong reaction to what I've not read.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for now, but be sure to check the Center for Media, Religion, and Culture's website at colorado.edu/CMRC for a special extended version of our conversation with today's guests. And be sure to connect with us. We are on Facebook and Twitter, and our Twitter handle is @CUBoulder_CMRC. We love to hear your thoughts and your feedback on today's show, and you can also receive updates there on future episodes of Sacred Lines here on KGNU. Today's show was produced by William Ramsey, Samira Rajabi, and myself, with special help from Maeve Conran from KGNU. On behalf of everyone at the Center for Media, Religion, and Culture at CU Boulder, our thanks again to our great guests today, Professor Rick Stevens, Rachel Watson, and Will Ramsey. And as always, our thanks to you for listening.